This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Isabel Aikman, and today we'll be talking to Professor Helen Curry about her new book, Endangered Maize, Industrial Agriculture and the Crisis of Extinction. Thank you, Helen, for joining me today. It's fantastic to have you on the podcast.
Thanks very much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the conversation today.
Great. So could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your research interests and how you came to the topic of endangered maize?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Well, I'm the Melvin Kranzberg Professor in the History of Technology at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta in the United States. And I am or consider myself, broadly speaking, a historian of science and technology in the recent past. And what that has meant for me is looking especially at the history of the life sciences and biotechnological developments and change as they have intersected with especially agricultural development. So a significant amount of my time and research in the past has been really centered on thinking about plant breeding, about how research scientists and other individuals go about creating new kinds of crops and vegetables and flowers and so on. And then more recently and more related to the book that we're going to be talking about today, I've been thinking about what one might kind of think of as the flip side of plant breeding, which tends to sort of set plants and crops in particular tracks. I've been thinking about efforts to conserve diversity genetic diversity in crop plants, especially. And so this is the effort to not winnow down plants to a perfect form, as we might think of in plant breeding, but really see what diversity is out there in the world, think about where it is, why it might be used, and especially how it might be conserved in order to be drawn upon in the future in various different ways. So my research interests have been on plant breeding and its various kind of uses and also consequences in the world.
Yeah, they're brilliant ideas to drive research. And looking at kind of one particular species is such a great way of bringing plants into historical writing. And you're reading your book, it's clear that maize is such a fascinating plant to choose as a protagonist because it's so foundational to our global food system. But I'll be completely honest and say that I had hardly any knowledge about maize before reading this book. And I was hoping that you could give us a high-level character profile of maize and speak to what a study of maize can reveal about our understanding of biological diversity and extinction.
Yeah, so, well, let me sort of take a step back in some ways to talk about, so in As I said, just in characterizing my research, I've been interested in efforts to conserve crop diversity. And when I really started out on that project, I was thinking in really general terms. I wasn't interested in maize specifically, but I was thinking about efforts to conserve crop diversity more generally, whether that was seed banking, so putting seeds in long-term storage or medium-term storage to make sure that certain lines continue, or whether it's seed saving, something that someone might carry on in their backyard or in their farm from season to season, or anything really kind of in between those two extremes of keeping seeds extant from season to season. And so I was interested in, thinking about apples and thinking about wheat and rice and all of these other things. But it quickly became apparent in trying to tell this history, one, that, as is so often the case in writing history, there was it was a bit too big of a story to try and explore in just one book, thinking about that great big landscape of crop diversity and what that might mean. But it also was the case that maize or corn, especially as it's referred to in the United States, kept cropping up as a plant that was important in thinking about how conservation would take shape, why it mattered, who would be the targets, where things would be preserved, and so on, and in what modes. And so that might be because I was coming at this, having been trained as a U.S. historian. Perhaps if I had been working in an Asian context, I would have zoomed in on rice as the crop that had the most to say about these particular issues. But being an Americanist, that brings me really to your question of corn and why it's so important in this story. It's obviously one of the top three global crops, along with wheat and rice. By some measures, it is the world's most produced crop. And it is, fundamentally important to the global economy today, has been for a couple of centuries, to political economy as well, to the ways in which nations have related to each other in terms of food aid and other kinds of kind of exchange relationships. And I can talk a bit more about that. But even more fundamentally, it has this incredibly long history in the Americas as a kind of cultural foundation, especially in Mexico, where maize originated, but also in other Latin American countries. And so this cultural significance, this economic importance, really meant that there were many people who converged on wanting to conserve maize and create structures for the continuance of maize diversity for a variety of different reasons, to serve different communities and different agendas. And that's really one of the reasons why I think it proved so productive in the book. It's certainly not the only story that one could tell about the history of efforts to conserve crop diversity, but it is one important lens.
Yes, and talking about the relationships between different communities and different people. So who are the organizations and communities that shape the history here? Who are you focused in on during your research?
Well, as a historian of science, my main agenda in writing this book was to really understand certain kinds of research traditions coming out of a professional science community. So my starting point was really thinking about professional plant breeders or commercial seed sellers, geneticists, plant biologists, taxonomists, and so on. A community of researchers and crop developers who were interested in corn, not chiefly from a perspective of their own culture or their own daily subsistence, except maybe in the sense of the source of their salary, but interested in it more with this lens of kind of science and economics. And I wanted to understand the actions that they had taken over about a century in order to explore and document and save genetic diversity in maize. But of course, in telling that story, the principal groups that they interacted with in those efforts were individuals growing corn, and chiefly individuals growing corn that were characterized as being kind of pre-industrial. So that in the story that I tell is indigenous communities of the Americas, really from the United States all the way through through Mexico, then through Central America and South America as well. And so I followed the professional communities that had been my kind of chief entry point as a historian of science through their engagement with various different cultures of corn cultivation, subsistence, and also ultimately conservation as well.
Brilliant. And you speak about kind of the century and the developments that happen over that century. We should say that we're talking about the 20th century, and your book is broadly chronological. So we start in, I think, 1916 with Harold Bigger in the Office of Corn Investigation, and then we end with these international agreements about the turn of the century. So could you draw out some of the key developments that you found whilst researching the book and what you follow throughout it?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different ways to break down what are the different timelines that matter in the book. One is probably in terms of plant breeding methods and tools and ideas. So at the turn of the 20th century, so in the late 1800s and early 1900s, corn cultivation in the United States, where the book starts, was really primarily centered on producing grain, especially to feed livestock, and doing so using what we call open pollinated varieties, so freely interbreeding populations of maize that might have clear varietal names, but would be a sort of combination of sometimes purchased on the market and sometimes seed saved on the farm by the farmer. And there was a lot of interest in helping farmers improve their methods of saving seed, but also developing new kinds of varieties that would be suited to different farming conditions around the United States at that moment in time. And what that latter trend, that trend of producing new lines to spread to farmers, really contributed to was an idea that things that farmers had grown before that they might have been saving on their farms, saving as seed from year to year, or that might only have a kind of regional specificity, would be gradually eliminated as the products of professional breeders and commercial seed companies came more and more to predominate. This is a concern that had been around, actually, I think probably a bit earlier in Europe and in other places, but this is the sort of moment where we start to see these concerns coalesce a little bit in the United States. And so with thinking about corn improvement or corn breeding and its intensification, the next real step is the development of hybrid corn. And that's a method of producing corn varieties for planting and production by farmers that took the step of seed saving out of the hands of the farmer for basically biological reasons that have to do with hybrids, F1 hybrid seeds specifically, not reproducing true from generation to generation. And so along with this transition to hybrid corn, you then see actually the kind of intensification of professional and commercial development of corn seed varieties, which intensifies this concern about whether older varieties will indeed disappear as farmers make a transition. And so the first part of the book really tracks that piece of history and then follows the concerns, especially of professional breeders and geneticists, as they observe a transition to hybrid corn and to the purchase of commercial corn seed in the United States, and then project that same trajectory in the United States to Mexico. to Central and South America to start to have a concern about farmers across the Americas who have traditionally cultivated incredibly diverse strains and varieties of maize, about that diversity possibly being winnowed down, and as a result, no longer available to scientists and breeders of the future. That's really the concern. So then I'll just say, and then I know that I've sort of, there's another answer to your question that I'm missing, but if we think about that trajectory, then, you know, the next big shift in terms of plant breeding technologies has to do with the introduction of genetically modified seeds and the way in which that sparks different kinds of activism and agitation around the spread of commercial seed varieties, especially in Mexico, where they're perceived to be particularly threatening to native varieties of maize. And so I deal with that history as well. So there's a whole kind of thread of events that have to do with plant breeding technologies. But at the same time, I think there's also a timeline to understand that's about ideas about indigenous peoples or local communities and notions of development and the idea that certain groups of people around the world are practicing means of farming and cultivation that should be quote unquote improved or developed in the language of development theory into quote unquote modern methods. And so we can also track the history of changing ideas about where and when corn varieties might disappear and why that would be a concern, not just along this trajectory of plant breeding technologies, but also ideas about development. So and this in the book stretches from Native American farmers in the American West, especially in the early 20th century, who are seen to be disappearing in the midst of economic change by observers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and elsewhere, to concerns about indigenous groups elsewhere in the Americas and the ways in which change happening in their communities might be causing them to, again, this is the perception, not the reality, but to kind of disappear out of existence. Two ideas about global development after World War II, this idea that, you know, actors from the United States should actively be going out into the world to modernize, as it were, peoples and communities and approaches to agriculture that they find elsewhere. And the ideas about radical transformation and loss and disappearance that are caught up with that. So that, I would say, is the other kind of timeline of major events that's important in the story.
And just to pick up more on that, I really enjoyed the way that you brought the wider political context into the narrative, especially the Cold War and the global economic changes. And this seemed especially important when discussions about genetic resources and access became global. Could you give us a feel for those key political developments and contexts that influenced this story?
So I think here it's important to start in some ways where my last comment left off with the immediate aftermath of World War II, and to think about the development of the UN system, I would say, and different UN agencies as sites where global concerns could be negotiated in distinctive ways. And so one of the shifts that's important in how the conservation of biodiversity comes to be a global concern, so not necessarily an issue just of plant breeders and geneticists who think they're losing raw materials for future development, but actually a concern about, as you've just said, it kind of global genetic resources that could be dissipated and this being a problem for future generations, for all of humanity. That's really caught up with the rise of environmentalism in many different contexts around the world in the 1960s and early 1970s, especially, and the existence of global fora. So the UN Food and Agriculture Organization is a key institutional actor in this story. Also, I would say organizations like the United Nations Environment Program and the United Nations Development Program. These are spaces where, we refer to genetic resources, but often what people quite frankly mean are seeds of diverse varieties that are thought to be useful in various different ways. But these global fora are a place where the control of and access to seeds as a resource for humanity come to be discussed and really kept on the high on a global environmental agenda right up until the present day.
And just picking up on the seeds, something I found really interesting was the story of seed banks, especially your observation that they were political and not biological. And there were these huge debates about what they should be used for and who should have access to the benefits. Could you give us an understanding of when seed banks first appeared and why they're created, and more about what the inherent power dynamics with seed banks were?
I think this is a great question, and my sort of opinion and assessment of it has changed over time. I used to try and put a pinpoint on when seed banks were invented, but it's really probably easiest to envision the seed bank as a sort of entity existing on a continuum and sort of coming into existence on that same trajectory. But a seed bank is really, at its core, just a collection, an organized collection of samples representing crop diversity, generally saved as seed, right? And so the seed bank, in a way, was invented long before any of these ideas of conservation came to be prevalent, if we think about communities or even individuals or farmers saving seeds and perhaps having samples of different varieties or different populations to maintain over time. But we might want to contest that and say, actually, there was a moment in time in which long-term conservation became the agenda of a seed bank, right? That it wasn't just about having resources for the next season. It was about having resources 30 years from now and 75 years from now and 200 years from now, or in the case of, you know, the Svalbard Global Seed Belt, much longer than that still. And so we might think, when did seed collections come to have this conservation agenda? And I think that is really about the turn of the 20th century, except that it wasn't really actualized very well in many places or in the places where people attempted it. And that's chiefly because actually maintaining a seed bank, especially if your interest is in the long term, and especially before refrigeration possibilities were what they are today, or freezing possibilities, keeping a seed bank is actually quite a bit of work. Seeds are living materials that eventually die in storage. And so it's not just about having the vision for creating a collection of seeds, it's also having the plan for how to regenerate those seeds when they reach a point in their lifespan that they're not likely to continue. Because seed banks, effective long-term conservation seed banks, need to have these material resources, I think this is a huge part of what makes them such a political issue, right? Because what happens in the 1970s, when there seems to be this general agreement that crop genetic resources are being lost in the midst of global development, these are important resources for food, for agriculture, for the future. At that moment in time, the places in the world that have the most effective long-term conservation seed banks are a handful of industrialized nations or institutions closely allied with those countries. And so it is a question of global equity, right? So making sure that there would be access to something routinely described by scientists in the 1970s as a kind of patrimony of humanity, that becomes a major issue. And so that's how the sort of concept of a seed bank and the biological work that it needs to do comes to intersect with a question about, I think fundamentally equity and access to resources.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it was very interesting to realize how much work goes into managing these seed banks and how so many of the seeds are actually lost because they can't be replaced with enough time. And one of the convincing arguments of your book was that seed banks work best when they're part of in situ conservation as well, and they're kind of part of this revolving use of seeds with local communities. So I was wondering if you could speak to that and speak about how conservation has changed and the idea of conservation has changed through these technologies and through these practices.
Yeah, so in the period of time that I was just talking about a moment ago, in the 1970s, especially and 1980s, a pretty effective system for conservation of crop genetic resources perceived to be crucial across different national contexts was really forged, and it was contested and challenged, and questions about access and equity that I was mentioning were sort of managed and brokered in different ways. But it wasn't just the political challenges that proved actually to transformative to ideas about seed banking. So there was the mobilization to set seed banks up. There was the negotiation over who should be able to access these and how they should be managed at an international level. But then as evidence started to mount that it was challenging for these now kind of international institutions to actually keep up with the influx of materials that were going into them, and as other questions about the agenda of global development and who ultimately it served kind of were playing out in the 1980s and 1990s, there really came to be a strong counter initiative in the world of efforts to conserve crop diversity, which was based on the idea that the ultimate conservators and the most effective conservators of crop diversity are farmers. And they are farmers who have incentives to continue to grow different varieties, whether for, to fit an economic niche, to fulfill a specific subsistence aim that they have, or to serve other uses. You mentioned, I think, the notion of in situ, so that's sort of on-site or on-farm conservation, really started to gather a lot of momentum, I would say, in the 1990s, as especially social scientists, but also agroecologists and ethnobotanists, began to work much more closely with farmers in especially marginalized contexts, so not necessarily in the heart of economic, agricultural, or global economic agricultural production, but of course, folks perhaps unfairly excluded from those contexts, who might have more reasons to be cultivating a variety of different crop types, to see those, so researchers and other actors started to see those farmers as really, I think in some cases just an alternate path, but in some cases actually a better path to conservation, and a better path in part because of the way in which conservation could then be linked to addressing other kinds of needs with respect to social justice and equality, right? So ensuring that farmers who wanted to continue working the land would have the resources to be able to do that, or to make sure that groups who had in a previous era been sort of the story had been written about them disappearing, right? As we see, especially in sort of accounts of the history of the United States and how Native Americans in the U.S. were perceived for so long, in order to kind of rewrite a narrative of continuity, of resilience, of resistance, of growth. And so in situ conservation, on-farm conservation was also not just caught up with these ideas about biological conservation, but I think much more with ideas about social justice and how conservation could also serve that agenda.
And those relationships between the way that we think about biology and the way that we think about society seems to be so linked throughout all of the events that you look at throughout the book. And these imaginings of endangerment and the societies of local communities, which seem to, you say, be seen as inherently endangered. And that kind of shapes the way that organizations approach crop diversity management as well. And I was hoping you could speak to your kind of final argument in the book that crop diversity and human diversity are inherently intertwined and therefore must be protected together. If you could speak more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, for me, this point was kind of the revelation of writing this book. As I've said before, starting out as a historian of science and technology and really being interested in the plant breeding, the crop science, the biotechnology, and delving into this history with that sort of those blinders on already. And then increasingly observing my actors having a blindness about the fact that they were actually dealing with farmers and with communities and cultures and being kind of, in a way, astonished by that. How could collectors from the United States who were going out to find maize in Mexico in the 1940s write a whole book about the diversity of maize that didn't even attempt to deal with the diversity of humans, the diversity of farmers and farms, and the diversity of cuisine? And I was shocked by that. And then, of course, I had to reflect on my own way of going about this history, which was to start with precisely the same kind of questions as the actors that I had. And so what I hope has come out more in the end is what you described in terms of actively thinking about what some of these sort of strictly, you know, plant science based or strictly plant taxonomy inflected visions of researchers, what they were missing, right? What the world that they were actually engaging with was not a world necessarily just of plants, but a world of people and plants together. And so what happens if we put that other part of the story back in to our accountings? And then that also, of course, plays into where I conclude the book in reflecting on how we might rethink actually the sort of project of conservation in order to account for some of the kind of failings of past actors, some of those blindnesses that they might have had to the worlds that they were encountering.
Yeah, you really speak to a problem which I think is prevalent for a lot of historians in kind of reassessing the way that you go about your research and making sure that you don't have the same biases that you're kind of assigning to the characters that you're studying as well. It's difficult.
Absolutely. And I think, one of the things that I want to make absolutely clear in this interview and that I, again, I hope really comes through in the text is the extent to which a lot of the ideas that I put forward there, especially in the conclusion, are the places where a lot of conservation or crop conservation geneticists are at today with respect to thinking about conservation in motion, conservation in change, right? That we need our crop plants to be dynamic. We need our research to be dynamic to reflect that. And so those sort of ideas that the history brought me to are also, the ideas that today's conservationists are really dealing with.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a history book, but the history of crops and biodiversity is such an important context for the current environmental situation. Is there anything else that you like to add to where you see your research contributing to our current understanding of biodiversity and providing insight into how we should approach it?
Well, so I think there's two things. One is what I just mentioned. I'm struck by the extent to which it's difficult to think about conservation because in other areas of biodiversity conservation, we are like absolutely tethered to the story of loss. There is dramatic species loss. There is habitat loss. There is, the depletion of resources, right? The depletion of global forests. And so conservation is really wrapped up in a story which is about loss. Crop genetic diversity is a little bit different because we can also think about creating diversity through new combinations, through cultivation over time, which drives populations in different directions, right? So it is a kind of a different kind of enterprise. And I think if there's, a place for this story that I'm telling here to really be a reminder that we can't just be telling stories of loss, at least not in this area of biodiversity conservation, because that limits us to a notion of, finite heritage, for example, or this idea that, heirlooms, these are things that existed in the past and we steward them to the future. Actually, we can be thinking about how to restore diversity and grow diversity, and that's important too. I think maybe I'll stop there on that point.
Yeah, I think throughout the book it does feel like a story of optimism in the end. You come to the end of it and you feel like there is something that can be done, and we're learning more about how to manage landscapes and biodiversity protection. So that is very refreshing, I think, in the story of environmentalism.
I'm glad you felt that way. I think it was important to me that a story that I think involves, talking about discrimination, prejudice, marginalization, in addition to biodiversity loss, dealing with these problems, the consolidation of corporate control over the food supply, these are really heavy things. But I think to remind us that history needs to do the positive work of moving us forward, I think was really important to me. And that reminds me also, I think something else that I hope the book does for some readers, at least, the more I study the global food system, the more I realize I don't know about the things that I eat every day, corn among them. And so, I hope there's also something for some readers, at least. I know many will come with even greater expertise than I bring to it here. But appreciating what what a global staple crop can be, and the role that it's played in different cultures, but also in different areas of biological research, for example, and linking, you know, that history to then the tortilla in your next taco dinner. I think that's also something that I really hope the book does.
Definitely does. I mean, personally, for me, I had purple maize chips at the weekend, and I was able to confidently give a little bit of a brief history about them, having read your book. So it was, I was bragging, I think, a bit of that.
That's wonderful. That's excellent.
And I think what the book does fantastically is really illustrate all of the varieties and, you know, the technologies that fit into this book with the images that you've chosen. And I was hoping you could talk a bit about where you found those images and how you think they bring the story to life. I remember one particular one that I enjoyed was the different varieties of the maize corn cob. And it just really demonstrated how different these varieties are. So yeah, to speak more about that.
Yeah, well, I should say, and here I owe a great thanks to the Rockefeller Archive Center. A lot of the images from the book, or I guess I wouldn't know off the top of my head exactly how many, but several of them certainly are from the collections of the Rockefeller Foundation, which had some significant programs of maize development and conservation, not only in Mexico, but elsewhere in Central America, and then a bit in South America as well. And they reflect obviously only a part of the story, the part of the story that a foundation funding development work wanted to tell about maize diversity and maize development. But I think they do provide a sense of the kind of on the ground science and conservation activity that was happening in different places. The images, I tried to select things that I thought would especially shed light on different kinds of practices of conservation and research around diversity, which took different shapes at different times, from, you know, what are the tools of exploration. So I have the ethnobotanist Hugh Cutler and his wife Marion getting into a canoe in South America as they travel in search of maize diversity, to Edgar Anderson measuring, you know, corn cobs in order to precisely chart the genetic the distribution of their genetic qualities, to, as I've said, the Rockefeller Foundation researchers in context, working with scientists in Mexico and elsewhere to try and work with maize diversity, to the kind of flowcharts and diagrams of the information age, in which genetic resources are partly thought of as information that must be correctly managed and transferred and curated from site to site. And then I think some of the final images are really about in situ conservation, the work that social scientists going into different sites, hoping to engender conservation practices and activities carried out in the 1990s and later. And I should say, I thanked the Rockefeller Foundation, but there are actually some incredible people who shared materials with me. So one of the social scientists who was working on a project called Project Milpa generously shared photographs with me. Researchers working in Mexico at the Colegio de Postgraduados, where one of my main actors did most of his teaching and research, dug up old file cupboards of photographs to sustain them. So that's an area where I really am deeply grateful for the labor of others.
Yeah, it sounds like such a fantastic archive trip and research project. Was there anything particularly interesting that you found in the archives, or something that you didn't know about maize before that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I mean, I think what I would say is that, yeah, this project, which didn't start out, as I mentioned, as a book about maize, but which is obviously deeply immersed in that world, I guess what it led me to discover is just the incredible network and richness and depth of scholarship on maize from a variety of perspectives. It really is kind of incredible and humbling I feel like at every turn, because the book deals with different sites and different domains of science and different cultures, you know, every turn was again being humbled by the extent of my ignorance about a crop that I thought I was getting to know more about over time. And that one of the great joys as well, in addition to those who really helped with the photographs, was meeting especially the different maize researchers working today, learning about the history of maize science through their eyes, and learning about the kind of importance of the things that they continue to do. And that, yeah, I think that the living archive, I would say, was probably the most extraordinary piece to encounter.
Brilliant. And just finally, if you could give us an idea of what you're working on next.
Absolutely. I would be so delighted. A question that every scholar loves to have. I am currently the PI of a multi-researcher, multi-year project called From Collection to Cultivation: Historical Perspectives on Crop Diversity and Food Security. And that is based at the University of Cambridge, where I used to work. And the project is really, so here's one way to explain it. What I said at the beginning, that my work has especially been focused on plant breeding, biotechnologies, and crop science a bit more generally, I've really been focused on genetics and breeding as this sort of key element in understanding how crops come to be. But one of the things I learned in writing Endangered Maize, interacting with some of these scientists I just described, was just how much work beyond genetics and breeding matter in the creation of crop varieties for cultivation, for our dinner plates, ultimately. And so the project is really meant to bring together historians with different expertises and interests to tell histories about crops that decenter genetics and breeding, that really think about the whole range of different knowledge and labor and technologies that come to bear on crop development. And so that ranges from things like curation and database management in seed banks to plant health protection, so establishing quarantine measures and regulations and managing those through the kind of whole gamut of different kinds of activities that researchers do in the interests of developing and disseminating, basically the foods that we eat that make it to our dinner table at the end of the day. So that's my main enterprise at the moment.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. Can't wait to see more things coming out of that. Thank you so much for joining us, Helen. It's been absolutely fantastic to have you on the show.
It's been a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.